Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua.
With guest co-hosts.
Karch.
Super 49er.
Welcome to Polycast. This is episode 60. Wow, see? I suck. Okay. 37 to...
58 plus 10.
Yeah, if we really want to be geeky, one day we'll do one of those. This is episode 50 plus 20 minus 2.
Welcome to Polycast. This is episode 68. I'm Cardamandua. Joining me is Daniel Quick.
Might as well face it, you're addicted to Civ.
What about the no singing rule?
Oh, God.
Rules are meant to be broken.
Imran Siddiqui.
Ha.
Makalua.
Hello.
Head Super 49er.
Hello.
And Ken Badisher or Karch.
Hi. I've been wandering around in the wilderness for months.
Welcome back.
In the news, we discuss Alton CS Transition 2009 executive changeover and WePlayCiv.com being launched.
In the forum talk, we talked about what we thought was the weakest part of our games and a rule change, whether classical resources should be revealed earlier.
From the vault, why can't gunpowder units take city raider promotions?
In the research lab, we discuss the need for more happy and health buildings in the modern age, and we also discuss the request for an open borders agreement division.
Here's what's been making news in the Civ community.
I guess there's some big news to talk about.
Yes, yeah, somewhat.
Polton Transition 2009. This is the first Polycast episode that is not an official podcast of a Polton Civilization site. Now, in case anybody is wondering, if you look at the Polycast website now, as well as the Age of Nations website, you see that it is actually copyright Civilized Communication, which is the new umbrella label that I'm giving Polycast and Age of Nations, because I have retained ownership of those properties, even though I am no longer the chief owner and administrator of Apolton, as well as no longer being on the staff at all. In fact, the entire executive has had a complete changeover, not makeover.
Extreme Civ makeover!
Apolton is now owned by Robert Plump, who was formerly known as Cybershy, a junior staff member to this point, as well as someone who was just a lurker in the Civ community, Jerome Schweitzer. They are now equally chief owners and administrators. Guadalocuta Schneiders, Ming, Ra, and Solver also decided to leave the administration and the staff at the same time. They came to their own decisions in turn, respectively, after that. Locutus and Solver, along with Dale, have gone on to another Civ site that they have founded, while Ming and Ra have outright retired. All the regular co-hosts on this and Modcast and Revcast are remaining the same. I'm also continuing to serve as an advisor to the committee on CivCon 09, which is led by Anna Lee.
CivCon, woo!
There's a CivCon?
So, which site did Solver and Locutus go to?
They, along with Dale, have all founded WePlayCiv over at WePlayCiv.com. So you can read an official press release. It's on Apolton in the site feedback and news forum. It's also linked to from the Apolton homepage. I have also written an open letter to the Apolton and greater Civ community that talks about my decision in this regard. I have felt it was in the best interest of both Apolton as well as myself that I step aside. Apolton will continue. The site is not shutting down. I'll still be around. I'll still be browsing Apolton. Still going to be involved in the Civ community. Polycast will continue. All the other podcasts are going to continue. So Polycast, that includes Polycast, Modcast, and Revcast. That's not to say I don't have a passion for Apolton anymore. If I didn't have a passion for Apolton, I would have just shut it down. I just don't have the time, the emotional energy to be the chief owner administrator. So it's not fair to Apolton, the community, or myself to continue in that capacity. So That's why I came to this decision, but it certainly did not come overnight. I worked to ensure that there was a transition, that the site didn't shut down, and that the transition would be as smooth as possible.
I'm reading through this open letter to the Civ community, and there's something in here that just doesn't make any sense to me. The sentence here reads, "I am not claiming to be perfect." Now, who wrote this letter? Because it couldn't have been Dan.
That's not Dan.
Dan.
Dan had a ghostwriter.
He must have. Well, I got to say, for my part, I've been a member since 1999, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the future.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
I think we should start with, what do you think is the weakest part of your game? And the reason I want to start with this one is because the weakest part of my game is my game right now, since I haven't played Civ for about 8 months.
Whoa. You're pulling an Imran on us.
One of the problems I had is that I played Civ Rev for like 6 months.
That is a problem.
Right when it came out.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Oh, come on.
Oh, nice. I felt like I could say it because I was the RevCast host.
Okay. But I played that, and it kind of warped my civilization strategy, because I got so used to playing kind of in Civ Red mode with moving fast and just, and only the limited amount of options that it has, that when I went back to Civ 4, it was kind of like, it was different. It was hard to remember what to do.
That's actually really valid. And I actually brought it up in a thread yesterday, completely unrelated, that you can't even pair Civ Rev and Civ 4 because they're so different. And so when you try to go back and forth a lot, I tend to get confused a little bit. And even on RevCast, when I'm talking about things, I'm like, wait, can I do that in Civ Rev, or is that just a Civ 4 thing? I can't remember.
Well, I think the weakest part of my game right now is about the medieval period. It's falling behind in technology, and this is more a specific reference to multiplayer than single player, and a reference to a player or two in particular that seems to be that up to that point I managed to keep pace, doing better with my economy, doing better with military, but still the science is falling behind, and it's kind of a bit of an unfair thing to cite here simply because there's not a lot of particulars that I can give for anybody to try to help diagnose it. Other than that, I will say that until recently, my weakest part of my game was when to stop whipping and to start allowing the cities to grow. It's an art. It's not a science. But I would say once you've got yourself to metal casting and you can be building forges, once you've got code of laws and you've got courthouses, then you're able to start with the forges, start making even better use of hopefully the infrastructure that you've been building with your workers, with mines, for instance, and that your city placement has been such that you will have a good portion of your cities be able to have some kind of decent production. And then, of course, having courthouses, thereby reducing the maintenance cost, and also having the chance to spread religion, whether it's your state religion or somebody else's, get your temples as necessary so you can increase your happiness cap. So that way you don't feel like, oh, I have to keep my city population low. As I said, it can be a fine line, but there is a point where that strategy becomes anything but. It goes from being a positive to a negative.
Well, when I play, I think the weakest part may be simply that, I don't know, I like being a builder, and I tend to wait too long in order to, say, build up my defenses, that sort of thing, which in single player isn't that bad as it would be in multiplayer, because I would be, you know, run over. But I guess it's a thing that most people who play normally single player may have issues with in multiplayer, which I notice is a bit of a different situation in terms of building versus military-ish type of stuff.
Well, that's exactly what I found that one of my problems was, is trying to balance how I play single player with multiplayer and learning that it's not the same.
Yeah, multiplayer is definitely more military oriented if you want to stay in the game.
Yes, and whether that's having a big offensive army or at least having a substantial defensive army to avoid someone from attacking you.
Yeah.
One way or the other, military definitely plays a major role. And now it certainly does on the higher difficulty levels as well, and or with aggressive AI.
Mm-hmm.
Everything being relative to what people find difficult and aggressive. It's important to remember, this could be a weak part of your game. I like with the AI, they don't get that they're probably going to be screwed if suddenly in a tile right next to their border and my border, I've got this huge stack that sits for turns and turns and turns. Well, you know, a human player could pick up on that and realize, this doesn't look good.
Maybe I should build up a strong defense near that thing.
So always important to be, particularly in multiplayer, to do your best to keep the stack hidden until it is ready to actually move in. Because I used to think, oh yes, move all of my units as soon as I can to right where I want them to move in from. And then just keep adding them turn after turn after turn, so then the stack gets larger and larger and larger and larger. And yeah, that can be a problem.
Yeah, because this is pretty much a big giant flag of, look here, I'm about to come kill you.
Yes.
I think even the AI has caught on to that at this point. Let's see, what's my weak point?
Yeah, what is your weak point? You don't have any weak points.
Sure I do.
You've been spending all this time thinking about your weak points.
Oh, I have weak points. I forget this little thing. I get off onto teching things and improving my cities, and I go, oh, right, military, right about the time I get invaded. I lose too many games to this.
Oops.
Oh, yeah, oops.
What happened to all my cities?
Oh, wait. Right, two isn't enough. Okay. Less likely to do that in multiplayer, but we had one the other day where, a few weeks ago. Anyway, where I probably could have been in a better position, except I'd forgotten to build a military because I was too busy going, ooh, tech, shiny, ooh, nobody's fighting. Okay, I'll just go tech, ee, cities, yay. Oops.
Oh, yes, and even last week's game, you were on a continent by yourself. And I had all of the AIs on my continent. And what war ends up being declared, one of the AIs on my continent declares war on Mackie.
Yes!
Wow.
Because I was looking at the power graph, and I was getting ready for a fight. I had a really crappy start. I didn't have copper for the longest time. I didn't have iron until the later game, and copper was all I had. So I had this huge stack of Axeman on the border just trying to keep things defended. And I'm thinking, Maceman, must get. And then all of a sudden, I'm getting ready for war, and we're like, I see war declared, and I'm like, oh, crap, against Mackie, what? Now, it wasn't much of an invasion force, but still.
Were you just playing just the two of you in that game?
No.
Oh, okay.
Just the two of us.
You just said it in such a way, I was like, wait a minute.
I'm just thankful to say that the weakest part of my game is no longer, let's go into world building.
That's pretty bad.
How about the rule change? Van Attevelt. Rule change to reveal classical resources earlier. For myself, I'm fine kind of the way it is. The only bad thing I see, of course, is if you don't have the resource you need for your UU, but I can't see revealing everything early. Although there were a couple interesting points, I thought, to reveal things based like on a culturally based resource map. But generally, I like it the way it is.
In this thread, I did like the suggestion about revealing but being able to make use of it, not necessarily at the same time. Some people who were suggesting that, yes, I think it should be revealed sooner, but that you then need a later technology in order to actually be able to use it. I'm extrapolating. For example, yes, mining reveal copper and or iron, but not be able to use it until, say, bronze working and iron working, respectively.
Yeah, people knew there were shiny rocks. They just didn't know what to do with them.
Huh. I definitely don't like the idea of having them revealed earlier, and then, yes, you could make use of them earlier. Like part of the strategy, for instance, is scouting out your immediate area, hopefully with a scout. So then when you get those particular technologies, when you get animal husbandry for horses and the bronze working and the iron working, as already mentioned, then you can see at a glance, oh, this is where I need to expand to soon. And of course, there is an element of luck. Sometimes you're like, yes, copper and the big fat cross, awesome in your capital, or at least within your cultural borders right away. But Threadstarter is like, strategically, I think this makes more sense as you get more info to base your decisions on, removing some of the bigger gambles from the early game. Well, I think it's a fair gamble.
I don't know, though. I think this is only valuable to people who like to do rapid expansion. I mean, it doesn't really take that long to get bronze working and animal husbandry. And once you have those, you can, once you can use the resources, you can see them. So I think it's only important for people who just want to get a whole lot of cities out there early, and they feel cheated if they end up settling just one square too far away from an important resource for them. Although I do think that cultures whose unique units depend on certain resources, they should be able to see those resources. I mean, it seems kind of silly to me that they don't, that they can't. I mean, if you're dependent on that resource to do well in the game.
Yeah, what also might be helpful is, similarly, is if Regenerate Map was still available for, like, say, the first 25 turns or something. Because sometimes it looks okay on the first turn, and then you explore a little area with whatever unit you get, and you go, oh, crap.
Yeah.
As far as the unique unit and the resource, are you saying then, Karch, that if it's a unique unit and you require that resource for a unique unit, that you should be able to see that from the outset of the game? Is that what you were getting at?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe only for ancient era unique units, I don't know. But Romans are at a significant disadvantage, for example, if they can't get iron. You want to know if you're going to have to go on the warpath to get some iron early on. That really affects your strategy, and it really affects your ability to do well in the game.
Yes, and so then I would argue that if you are playing as Rome and you realize that the Praetorians are important, that you will want to go for ironworking as soon as it is feasible so you can find out where the iron is so you can go for it. I don't think you should be able to see it from the start of the game.
I suppose. Maybe. I don't know. It's a hard question.
On the question, the suggestion, kind of the middle of the road between the yes and the no, which is one tech for reveal and then another tech for making it available. If that was a change that was put in the game, I wouldn't object to it. But I think it's better off the way it is, because then it just seems to be a bit more unnecessarily complicated.
Yeah.
Yes, I've got this technology, and I can use it. I can see it, but I can't use it? What the hell do you mean?
It definitely would be confusing for newbies.
As already some people have said, for instance, right from the outset of the game, you can see cow on the map, but until you actually get animal husbandry, you're not going to be able to make use of it. So that would just be adding another situation where I can see it, but I can't make use of it. Are you kidding? Actually, the same with being able to see ivory from the beginning and not being able to build camps. I actually thought an interesting related point was from Soirana. He said, I'd rather see marble and stone revealed by masonry. That's an interesting point, seeing how, of course, particularly with stone, that can be really beneficial in deciding whether you want to go for some certain early wonders or not. I still think it's more important that it remain for militaristically important resources, and I think a better argument for that is perhaps having it so that ivory cannot be revealed until, say, well, just make it at hunting even, for instance. Not necessarily right off the map. Sometimes, hey, if you start with hunting, you got a bonus. You see ivory right away. I realize it's classified as a luxury resource, but I think most people think of it in terms of its military advantages, potential military advantages. Venetevel, saying like it can be quite a gamble to tech bronze working, iron working before you know whether that will help with your defense. It should be able to help in your defense. And it should, because it will then either reveal to you copper and iron, or reveal to you where you need to expand next in order to be able to get that. So I think it's a gamble to not research those technologies.
Yeah.
Even if you have ivory and you know that from the beginning, recognize you're not going to be able to make use of those war elephants until construction. So even then, saying, well, I've got ivory, so I guess I don't have to worry about bronze working or iron working. No. Beyond the considerations of you don't want to go too far down one tech tree path, because then those technologies become too expensive because you've missed some earlier ones later on. Even if that wasn't the case, and it is, you got to get to construction first. While other people are getting their bronze working and their iron working, and they're coming at you with their axemen and their swordsmen and maybe even some horse archers. Well, you might be able to survive if you have a sufficient number of archery units, but you're really going to handicap yourself.
Yeah, about all you can do is throw your ivory at them.
Hey, they're kind of sharp and pointy.
Yes, and you want to throw the sharpie point at them. You don't want to...
Oh, yes, that's probably true. This is a Vault segment with topics cut from earlier episodes but have found relevance again later.
From episode 62 with Dan Q, Makalua, Imran Siddiqui, Snoopy369, James Robertson, and R. Rollo 1. Why can't gunpowder units take city raider promotions? Asks Krill over at CFC, that's K-R-I-L-L-E. He says, yes, why can't gunpowder units take the city raider promotions? Well, siege, e.g. cannons, and melee units, e.g. macemen, and armored units can. This handicaps makes macemen better city attackers than musketmen. Weird! Exclamation point.
Didn't he answer his own question later in the thread there? I mean, later on, he said, macemen equal 8, musketmen equal 9, enabling city raider for musketmen would make for a very rough transition. If you gave them city raider, wouldn't the first person who got gunpowder pretty much run roughshod over the rest of the planet? I mean, that's pretty much the way it worked in real life, but you've brought up before, Dan, that this is more about gameplay than accuracy, and if the first guy to get gunpowder was able to just stomp everybody nearby, that'd be the end of the game right there.
Well, and even more so, I think musketmen have never been attacking units, per se, and that's not really their purpose. In Civ 4, the French can use musketeers to that advantage sometimes, and could more so, I think, in earlier versions of the Civ 4. But musketmen, that's not even their purpose anyway. But certainly it's a gameplay issue. Certainly with grenadiers, I think, is the better question because they're actually city attack units. Giving grenadiers city raider would make them too powerful for the time period they're in. And you notice even with Beyond the Sword, they ended up, you know, essentially nerfing grenadiers and forcing you to get them a little bit later anyhow because they were still too powerful. But I have no doubt that when Soren sat down and said, okay, who's getting what promotion, that was the reason for it. Very similar to the reason why you don't have a clear upgrade path in naval ships from galleys or whatever. You can't take your galleys and make them into destroyers and battleships and whatever.
Yeah, I bet this one fell out in game testing, where they probably originally gave musketmen city raider and then found out just how bad an idea it was.
Well, I mean, I don't think they ever gave musketmen city raider, though I wasn't there at the time, but musketmen are essentially the spearmen upgrade path. The maceman or equivalent has always gone up to a different unit, like a grenadier or whatever. Musketman's not really ever been intended for an offensive unit. It's more of a city defender. It's an archer. Really, say it's an upgraded archer, essentially.
I must say that I really can't imagine what happens if musketmen could get city raider. Mainly because the only promotion that could stop a gunpowder unit is pinch. It comes with gunpowder too. It would be extremely complicated to counter someone with musketmen without pinch, and the fact is that it would be a race to gunpowder and game over. I pretty much agree with what was said before.
I'm actually not sure about that. I mean, to me, musketmen are only one better than macemen anyhow. They don't have any innate disadvantages, but they don't really have any innate advantages either. I don't know. I mean, to me, I don't think the question of do musketmen get city raider ever even came up. I think it's do grenadiers ever have city raider. That's the more interesting one. Which still, I mean, still would be, you know, prior to Beyond the Sword would have been a race to grenadiers, which often the game was anyway.
Like it was in Warlords.
Right.
In Warlords, it was a complete race to grenadiers and cannons. Game over.
Exactly. And cannons, I think, are the more interesting question, because cannons do have city raider, and if you get to cannons when other people aren't in gunpowder, you've won the game, because all you do is you just fire a few cannons off at them, and then could take spearmen or archers even along with you at that point, because they're just going to be attacking units that have, you know, 1.0 left or 2.0 left anyway.
Yeah, the big city that you weren't able to take out minutes before, as soon as you get artillery, it just goes away, yeah.
Cannons and catapults, the main reason why they weren't allowed to kill units off anymore and have a little bit higher limit to what they can take them down to, it's probably even still the most valid strategy at that point in the game anyway. But, you know, giving city raider to grenadiers would just be too much.
Later on in the thread, Krill says, I guess the real issue is how macemen retain their city raider 3 promotions when upgraded to riflemen, assuming, of course, you get to that point on the path. I think that on upgrading a unit to a non-CR unit type, for every existing city raider promotion the unit has, it should be removed, and the unit should use one level so new promotions can be picked instead. This would seem balanced to me. In fact, I think you should be able to repick all promotions on upgrade. Anti-archery mechanized infantry, come on now.
Well.
Let's go back to gameplay versus realism again.
I think the reason for retaining the promotions is sort of to balance it. You do lose the experience points. Unless you're a great general unit, you lose, you know, all the way down to 10 experience points. So if you've got, you know, a substantially experienced unit, it's got 4, 5, 6 levels, you're going to be losing those experience points anyhow, and you're pretty much never going to get another level at that point. So, you know, it's sort of to balance that out a little bit, you retain the levels. But ultimately, if the gameplay-wise, they don't want you to be able to retake your promotions because it gives more value to thinking about your promotions in the long term instead of in the short term. It's almost like the difference between, you know, playing, I'm going to go to the MMORPG geek mode here, but playing Guild Wars versus playing EverQuest. In EverQuest, you have to pick your increasing levels, you have to pick, and you're sort of stuck with whatever you pick then. Whereas Guild Wars, you just take whatever 10 you have at any one time. It's a very different game balance situation when you can respec your character anytime you want to. And it's the same with units. It would make balancing giving units experience and upgrades much more difficult.
I kind of agree, but it's not nothing that already swept my mind, that part of recasting experience points. But if we go to the realism part, it doesn't make any sense. Come on, I know how to ski archers better, so I'm going to de-learn what I've learned and learn how to kill gunpowder units for no cost.
Yeah.
It's somewhat stupid, in my opinion.
Well, if you go to the realism point, upgrades in general are sort of stupid, because...
Well...
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future. We need more happy and health buildings for the modern age. My short answer is no.
How often do you really reach the modern age?
I haven't reached enough times to really notice.
Yeah.
Yes, we usually win before then.
I don't.
And that's what future tech is for.
Yeah, right. Doesn't that give you a happiness and
yeah,
a,
that's right.
a health?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Doesn't ecology help out with that, too? Everybody likes to mow down their forests, but you can set up ecology towards the end game, and if you have enough forests around, that actually helps with health and happiness, too.
I think if you're reading this thread, they're really just complaining about that small industrial area right after you get factories and before you get the modern tech. And I don't know. I think that if they are dropping their population as drastically as Levi, I think he's doing something wrong anyway. I think he's messing up somewhere else.
Mm. Yeah, I'm thinking his cities could already be food short before he gets hit with the health stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be. There is that period in industrial where pollution becomes a big problem, and it's before you actually have the health technologies and stuff. But that really shouldn't kill your population off.
And it shouldn't come as a surprise to you either. If you're checking your cities and you can see before you start losing population,
they'll be stinky.
Yes, exactly. You'll get that green face, and then you can look in and you can see not only, okay, this is how much health I've got in the city, this is how much unhealthiness I have, and then it will show you the difference. If it's a negative, anyway, and then you can hover over it and you can see where it's coming from. And yeah, you're right, particularly looking at the industrial age. As you're getting to that point, look at your cities. I would expect, certainly in any of your larger, decent-sized cities, whether that's a combination of production and commerce and research, that you have granaries in those cities. You have aqueducts in those cities. If they're coastal, perhaps you also have harbors in those cities, which in whole or in part have to do with health. And just because you can suddenly build those factories doesn't necessarily mean that you should.
Yeah. Early factories can really hurt a city if you're not ready for them.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think you need to be using that strategy just a little bit more and say, am I quite ready for a factory here? And you get some players, and I'm not saying that this gentleman is one of those, who feel like they need to put everything in every city. Maybe they're kind of newbies at the game or something. At least when I started playing, I felt that way. And I know that talking to other people, they felt the same way, that, oh, I have factories. This will give me all these bonuses in all these cities. And then it's overkill, and they just killed their cities.
Yeah. And again, I want to point out, don't chop down all your forests. It's very tempting to chop down all your forests earlier in the game, but it really does help your city's health to have a lot of forest around them later in the game.
I don't chop down all my forests because they're pretty.
That's another good reason.
I do chop within my cultural borders of a particular city. Later on in the game, if I'm feeling a crunch, I sometimes actually take workers just outside the cultural border and I'll chop those forests, but that's very situational. Eventually, of course, later on in the game, I still have forests in the game. They're now within my cultural border, but they're not within any particular city's fat cross. And I've got some workers and time to spare. I will go and I will put forest preserves on them.
Uh-huh.
Because I would like them, for instance, to be able to spread to some of those other tiles, because that could help with, oh, say, the possibility for global warming later on, where it could mean the difference between, oh, that forest is gone and now it's plains, as opposed to that terrain just being a plain and it's now a freaking desert.
Right.
Also with the forests, it can be helpful in thinking long term, having a city with the national park, national wonder. You're going to lose your access to coal, but you will get happiness from each one of the forest preserves in that city. And as we noted before, you get happiness from those, even if those tiles are not being worked, which is really helpful, because if that wasn't in there, it would be kind of like, well, how is my city going to be able to grow large enough to make use of that if that wasn't in there? But all you have to do is have them within the Fat Cross and built, and they will be able to make use of that. Perhaps you're playing a game where you don't have a lot of healthiness resources, for instance, because there's also...
Yep. Fish, corn.
Yes, all of those that, for a grocer, for instance, plus one for bananas, spice, sugars, and wine.
Yeah.
And, of course, the harbor will give you plus one from clam, crab, and fish. And the supermarket, plus one from cow, deer, pig, and sheep. Perhaps you have very little of those resources, either natively, or you're not even able to get them imported from somewhere else, then perhaps find where in the industrial era, right before just about the time you get factories, think, okay, even if I get to the point of being able to build recycling factories, which is going to get rid of all of the unhealthiness from buildings, it's still going to be in a deficit. And even if I've still got the granary aqueducts built in there, identify your unhealthiest city, and then decide, perhaps that should be my city with the national park, which you could get with biology.
There's something actually you brought up there that people might not even be thinking about, and that is trading for food in the late game. I tend to ignore trade at times just because usually I try to build myself up enough that I have access to all the resources I need. But if you're having health problems, get yourself some of those health buildings and trade for food.
Yes, I mean, you may very well have excess of, say, some happiness resources, and your happiness cap is fine, but your unhealthiness is like, holy crap, find another sieve where they've got some health resources that they can give you and trade for some happy that they don't have.
Food is usually cheap to trade for, too.
Yeah, in single player, the AI is almost always willing to trade that.
Yes, and I've noticed that I play on Prince now, so I've gone from Settler right up to Prince, and really there doesn't seem to be, at least in that range, the AI behaving hardly at all in terms of difference, in terms of being more or less willing to trade. Even as I go up, there's, as you said, they're still willing to trade for those at a reasonable exchange, too. This person, he suggested some more buildings, not just for unhealthiness, we've addressed the unhealthiness, but also the happiness buildings. Some of his health ones, the health club and the water reservoir, and a couple of his happiness buildings were set like an amusement park and a zoo. Actually, when I read zoo, I immediately thought of SimCity.
That's what I thought, too. Actually.
But again, with the generating the happiness, later on in the game, I would assume by that point that you have some kind of religion in your cities, and you in turn have some of those religious buildings. But if you really are for want for religion and happiness, there are coliseums. I forget what technology gives you that.
Theater?
Theater's happiness bonus goes up the more you spend on culture, too. So if you're having serious happiness problems, you can solve it by adjusting your spending if you have theaters everywhere.
And I think it is okay if your sieve is unhappy for a couple turns. I don't think you have to bend over backwards to keep them constantly in that happy range for the whole game. I think there are times when you have other things to worry about. He's concerned about war weariness, and yeah, you're going to get that if you're in a war, especially if it drags on. You can try and prevent that with some of the wonders and things like that, but a couple turns, a game, I don't think is going to really cripple your game.
Yeah, when it comes to the unhappiness, have a look in your individual cities and see how many workers are refusing to work. When that's going on, and that's for an extended period of time, then maybe it's time to worry about it a little more, give it a little bit more attention. But as soon as there's an unhappy, you don't have to go into red alert.
Yeah. It's a playstyle thing, too. If you make a lot of big cities, really huge cities, and you don't have a lot of religion around, you're going to get overcrowding unhappiness. It's just you have to watch the growth of your cities and make sure they don't grow too fast. So that's another thing about leveling all your forests and building farms and mines and stuff. If you overfeed your population, they'll grow too fast.
Oh, and the other health building I forgot to mention was public transportation.
Yeah. Aren't there wonders that help with happiness and health, too?
The Hanging Gardens does. Any other wonders that help with health?
Three Gorges Dam.
Yes, indirectly, because then you have power through hydro and you don't have to build your coal plants.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's various happiness wonders.
Oh, yes.
The religious ones. I think the bottom line is that Moshe Levi needs to adjust his playstyle so that he's not growing his city so fast and building so much production in them until they can handle it. if you're going to put coal power and factories in all your cities, they're going to get unhealthy.
Well, yeah, there are trade-offs that has to be made.
You have to wait until you have the mitigating technologies or buildings before you start building that stuff if you're concerned about it.
The request, Open Borders Agreement Division, by Conrad Cabral.
Conrad Cabral?
This idea came to me because I hate to let treacherous dictators and their filthy armies walking across my graceful country just because I want the commercial benefits of the agreement. Besides, a friendly neighbor who wants those same benefits is obligated to let them pass to attack me, and I have a few arguments to stop this. Open Borders Division, civil open borders for scouts, workers, merchants, commercial open borders, trade routes, military open borders. The different levels of these would change the anger caused by spies getting caught. And he also suggested a possible variant is that each stage would require the others to complete. For instance, you must have a cross-border trade, which is the civil and commercial combined. You must have that established first in order to be able to get to open borders for military, if you want, and then defensive pact, and then permanent alliance.
I actually kind of like part of his idea. I like the idea of saying, yeah, we can have open borders, sort of.
Yeah, your scouts can come across, your works can cross, but you keep the military over there, young man.
Yeah, and no settlers. You can't send a settler through my territory. I'm not really into that.
Of course, you know, there's got to be some sort of trade-off as well, which is you don't get as many benefits from increased trade or something like that. Maybe half trade-wise and all that sort of thing.
So you're proposing that you have tariffs imposed on you automatically unless you have a full open borders agreement?
Basically.
Or, like, you can set out this specific agreement with the civ. You have various options you can choose from how you want it to run or something. I don't know. That might be kind of complicated.
Yeah.
I agree, though, that it does need a mitigating balancing factor, the sort of intermediate open borders, because otherwise why would you ever use military open borders ever?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason.
Also, I think making it have a variety of options might not work with the AI. I don't think it'd be able to necessarily navigate those options in a way that, well, people would like.
Well, I mean, you could have them have preferences. And maybe depending on the type of civ it is, it'll have a certain preference for something. Or maybe there'll be times when you can't make it work with them.
Even based on maybe what civics you're both running, that you could be far more nuanced, and I think the AI wouldn't catch on. But I kind of like the idea of some of this.
I think that in terms of the AI using it, I don't think you would see any more surprises than you see now, because even as things are now with an aggressive AI, they're programmed to act like a human player anyway. They will attack you for no reason and do crazy stuff that human players will do.
Yeah.
So I don't think this would really affect how you interact with the AI. I mean, you can't make a fair deal with an aggressive AI, for example, because the instant that they detect that they have an advantage over you, they're going to use that advantage.
Right.
Calling today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at polycast@apolton.net.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
There was an old strategy, rubber knife, where you kind of show near his heavily defended city. In the meantime, you're coming around to make a coastal attack, which they usually leave their cities very guarded. On the back end, maybe only one or two units in a city. You could easily take two coastal cities quickly that way.
It's a common strategy, I would say, even for a lot of players to, yes, we've got our military and we've got all these cities, but we're paying attention often to by land. Where can people get to? And that's where we end up concentrating our units. And then in some of your other cities that are considered quote-unquote safe, and you're thinking land considerations, there aren't that many units in there, and they may not exactly be the most up-to-date technologically either. Red Banana says, what was the longest time you spent playing Civ? For me, it was from 5 p.m. to 6 a.m. Holy crap.
Whoa.
10 years.
I'd say it was 8 hours. And that was a multiplayer game.
In Civ 2, you know, I used to play, I don't know, 5-6 hours. Well, Civ 2 was the first one I got, I think, as I said in an earlier podcast, and so... When I got it, after the first week where I was like, what the hell am I doing? When I got it, I just started playing it obsessively. So I think, I mean, I'm not sure. There may have been some really, really long play games where I look at the clock and it's 4:30 and I'm like, oh, crap.
It's even more fun when you are sitting there and you start playing, say, at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. Now I'm just going to play a couple hours and go to bed. Why is it getting lighter in here? Oh, crap.
I think perhaps the question is, what is the longest time you spent consecutively playing Civ, like in the same session? Because you could have a game that took you 10 hours, but you did 2 hours. This day, 1 hour, another day. I mean, he's saying all-nighters, or all-dayers, as someone put it.
I think the longest was our multiplayer game, and that was like 8 hours, I think.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of, too.
Yeah, I know either with Civ 1 or Civ 2, I've had ones that was literally all day, like 10 or 12 hours. But now I can't sit still that long.
Yeah, I had a really hard time with that myself.
I've had all day games, but I don't play them for more than a couple hours at a time. I'll play a couple hours and I'll get up and do something and just leave the game on and come back to it in a half hour or an hour or so. There's some guys on this thread talking about how I'm sitting in one place for 10 hours playing Civ, not doing anything else, that seems.
Wow.
Scary and unhealthy to me.
That sounds like there's something wrong with them.
Geeks.
I don't know that. I couldn't do that.
Yeah, you need bio breaks in more ways than one after that long.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, come on. They just strap on a Wizinator.
And a poop sock?
It reminds me of One More Turn, the advertising commercials that they did, sort of.
Oh, the Civinon?
Yeah, Civinon, that's what it was. And it's like, I haven't gotten up to go to the bathroom in 3 days. And they're like, you didn't go to the bathroom for 3 days? I said, I haven't gotten up. And you're like, ah! Ah! That was
awesome.
Thank you for listening to Polycast episode 68. This is Ken Karch-Bodicher with Dan Quick.
Bye, all.
Cardamandua.
Bye.
Makalua.
See ya.
Ted Webster.
Bye.
And the ever popular and snarky Imran Siddiqui.
Keep on Civin.
Snarky.
Stealing Dan's lines.
After I mocked it on the forum.
I was about to say after you mocked it on the forums. Something that I've never said before and will probably never say again is that Imran, your answer actually helped me.
Oh.
Burn.
Go on, go on.
Good thing we're recording.
Oh, I guess this assumed Anna Lee was still with us.
Oh, I'm here. I just didn't notice that I was on mute.
Good job. Way to pull on me.
One thing you should know, it is not the size of your stack, it's how you use it.
That's what she said.
I'll do Senate.
Senate discussed nothing.
Senate was adjourned.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing right now.
That's what I'm doing too.
Ooh, me too.
Me too.
Not me.
Just wanted to be.
Oh, I thought we were all doing it.
Everyone does time. It. Barely even know you anymore.
Did you know him to begin
well,
with?
Well, I feel that after all these podcasts that I know Dan better than I want to.
Oh, right back at you, Imran.
Oh, thank you. Memories. nightmares.
Record date May 2nd, 2009. Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright 2009, Civilized Communication at civcom.net.